All right, so let me ask you. You got Commonwealth versus Sherry on your desk, right? And you're thinking, okay, another case about rape. What's the big deal? But trust me on this one. This one, we got to take a deep dive into. It's not just, three doctors you see convicted there and you think, oh, convicted of raping a nurse. But this case, it's really about how the law,
Gets messy.
yeah, messy, how it grapples with force and consent.
Force and consent, those are the big ones here. This case is fascinating and so important because it forces us to look at consent in the gray areas.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't a clear-cut, like, physical violence situation.
Right.
That's what a lot of people think of when they think of, rape.
Right, exactly. And you think of someone fighting back or,
Hey.
trying to get away. But in this case, there wasn't that kind of resistance,
Right.
but the convictions were upheld. So how did the court even get there?
Okay, so to understand that, let's back up,
Right.
lay out the facts.
Yeah.
It all started at a party, 1980. The victim, a nurse, and the three defendants, all doctors, same hospital,
Wow.
were all at this party. And according to her testimony, two of the doctors kind of steered her into a bathroom where the third doctor was waiting.
Okay, so I'm already seeing a power dynamic here.
Ooh.
Three doctors, a nurse. That's not exactly a level playing field.
Exactly. And it gets even worse. She testified that they basically carried her to a car, despite her saying no, protesting, telling her they were taking her to Rockport.
Hold on, carried her through a car. That's pretty forceful to me.
Right. And that's a key point here. She wasn't physically fighting back,
Right.
but she was verbally objecting.
Right.
The question is, was that enough? Was that enough to show she didn't consent in the eyes of the law?
You would think.
I
I
mean,
mean, you would think if someone is saying no, that should be enough.
Right.
Isn't that kind of just common sense?
You'd think so, but legally, it's not always that clear cut. Remember, the defense, what do they argue? They argued that she didn't physically resist. So how could they prove, beyond a reasonable doubt, that she wasn't consenting?
So how did the court address that? Did they just take her word for it?
Okay, so they did take her word for it, but it wasn't as simple as that. They didn't just blindly accept her testimony. They looked at everything, all the circumstances. They considered the power dynamic, the fact she was taken against her will, and I think most importantly, her consistent verbal protests the whole time.
So they were looking at the whole picture, not just focusing on the lack of physical resistance.
Exactly. And this is where Sherry really changes things. The court made it clear. Any resistance that shows an honest lack of consent is enough.
Wow.
They didn't require her to fight back physically.
That's huge. I mean, that acknowledges that there are many ways to show you don't consent, and that sometimes speaking up is the safest option or the only option. Like, what if someone freezes up in fear, or they're afraid that fighting back is going to make the situation worse?
And the court got that. Sherry shifted the focus from how the victim reacted to what the defendants did to create that situation.
That's really interesting to me. I mean, legally speaking, what happened next? I mean, did the doctors just accept the verdict?
Oh, absolutely not. No way. They appealed
Oh,
on
okay.
four main grounds, each one raising a really interesting legal question.
Okay, lay them on me.
The first one, they argued there wasn't enough evidence to convict them
Of rape.
of rape. They basically said, look, she didn't fight us off. Where's the proof?
I can see that point, at least from a purely legal standpoint. Like, how do you prove lack of consent beyond a reasonable doubt, especially when it's basically one person's word against another?
And that appeals the heart of it. But the appeals court, they stuck with that key phrase,
Any resistance?
any resistance. And they said her testimony, plus all the circumstances around it, that was enough to prove lack of consent.
So they basically said, we believe her, and that was enough. But what about the whole innocent until proven guilty thing? Doesn't that make it incredibly easy to convict someone based on just one person's account? What about false accusations?
That's a valid concern, and the court did address it. They emphasized that it's the jury's job. It's the jury that decides who's credible. They get to watch, the witnesses weigh the evidence and ultimately decide.
So it all boils down to the jury's judgment. But that seems like a lot of pressure, to put on just a group of regular people. I mean, how are they supposed to decide who's telling the truth when there's no, physical evidence?
It's a complicated process, for sure. And it's definitely open to debate. But the court, they seem to have faith in the jury system, hoping that with the right instructions, careful deliberation, they could reach a just verdict.
Yeah, I guess it really boils down to, who do you believe? Which story seems more believable? But what about the defendant's state of mind? Like, what if they genuinely thought she was consenting, even if they were wrong?
That's where the second ground of the appeal comes in, the jury instructions. The defense argued that the jury needed to be specifically told they had to prove that the defendants knew she wasn't consenting.
Wait, so they wanted the jury to get inside the doctor's heads and determine their intent. I mean, that's practically impossible. How can you ever truly know what someone else is thinking?
Exactly. It is incredibly difficult. And that's why the appeals court rejected that argument.
Oh, okay.
They said that proving a guilty mind wasn't necessary.
For a rape conviction.
For a rape conviction. They focused on the act itself, the forced sexual intercourse, not trying to decipher the defendant's thoughts.
So they were basically saying that actions speak louder than thoughts.
You could say that.
But doesn't that seem kind of unfair? Like, what if someone truly misinterprets a situation? They believe the other person's consenting even though they're wrong.
That's a valid point, and it takes us to a really nuanced legal concept called mistake of fact.
Mistake of fact. What does that even mean?
So basically it means that if someone genuinely believes the other person is consenting and that belief is reasonable, even if it's mistaken, they might have a legal defense.
So are you saying that if the doctors in this case truly thought, you know, she was okay with everything, they wouldn't be guilty?
It's not quite as simple as that. There's a catch. That belief has to be reasonable and in good faith. And in Sherry, the jury just didn't buy that the doctor's belief in consent was either of those things.
So even if they thought she was into it, it wasn't reasonable. Man, I'm really starting to see how subjective this all can get.
Oh, it is absolutely subjective. And that's where things get, you know, really tricky. What's considered reasonable can change depending on all sorts of factors, you know, like the power dynamics we were talking about, societal expectations about, you know, gender roles, and even just the specific circumstances of the situation.
Yeah, when you've got three doctors and a nurse, it's hard to imagine any scenario where a belief in consent would be seen as, like, truly reasonable by a jury.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah.
Sherry raises important questions about how those power imbalances affect her perceptions and expectations.
Okay, so we've covered two grounds for appeal.
Yes.
The evidence and then the jury instructions.
Mm-hmm.
What about the other two? Did they try to argue that something was wrong with the trial itself?
They did, yes. The third argument, it had to do with the judge's decision to exclude evidence.
Mm.
About the victim's past.
Okay.
Specifically that she had been raped before.
Oh, wow.
The defense wanted to bring that up, but the judge said, no way.
Why would they even want to bring that up? I mean, that seems completely irrelevant and incredibly insensitive to bring up her past trauma in court.
It does, doesn't it? But their argument was that her past experience with rape might make her more likely to see a consensual encounter as an assault.
Whoa, wait. So they're saying because she was raped before, she can't accurately judge consent now. That's just, I mean, that's messed up and potentially really prejudicial.
Yeah, you're not wrong. And thankfully, the appeals court saw it that way, too. They upheld the judge's decision, citing Massachusetts' Rape Shield Law.
Rape Shield Law? I don't know that one.
It's a law. It's designed to protect victims from having their past sexual history used against them.
Okay.
The idea is that a victim's prior sexual experiences are irrelevant to whether or not they consented in this case.
That makes a lot of sense to me. It seems like a common sense way to prevent victim blaming.
Right.
And keep the focus on the actions of the person accused.
Exactly. The court really emphasized that. These laws are crucial for protecting victims, you know, from unnecessary scrutiny, harassment, and making sure that the legal process is fair and impartial.
Okay, so the defense couldn't use her past against her.
Nope.
What about the last argument?
Okay, so their fourth and final attempt was a claim of prosecutorial misconduct. They said that the prosecutor acted improperly during the trial.
Okay, so what kind of misconduct are we talking about? Like, were they accusing him of withholding evidence? Or intimidating witnesses?
No, it wasn't that extreme. They pointed to a few specific things he did during a cross-examination of the defendants, arguing that he kind of went beyond the bounds of fair play.
So basically accusing the prosecutor of playing dirty.
Yeah.
Trying to unfairly sway the jury.
That was their claim. But the appeals court, they reviewed everything really carefully, and they said no serious issues.
Okay.
They said the judges have a lot of discretion in managing their courtrooms, and in this case, the prosecutor hadn't, you know, cross the line.
Okay, so the judge was keeping things in check. The prosecutor didn't do anything too bad to call for a new trial.
Right.
So what happened in the end? I know the doctors were convicted, but did their sentences stay the same?
This is where things get a little complicated.
Okay.
So while the convictions were upheld, the court did ED make one change.
Okay.
They vacated two of the rape charges per defendant.
Wait, I'm confused. So if each man assaulted her, why wasn't it three counts of rape each?
Because the appeals court, they decided that based on the evidence, it wasn't three separate acts of rape for each man.
Okay.
Remember, she testified that each man assaulted her once, one right after the other.
Right.
The court viewed this as a single continuous event, not three separate crimes.
It was kind of like a technicality. They agreed that a rape happened, but they were being specific about how many times they could charge them.
Yeah, you could say that. It shows how important those specific legal definitions are.
Right.
And how they can have a big impact on a case, even if the facts are essentially the same.
Okay, so let's recap what we've learned. Commonwealth v. Sherry, this case, kind of threw a wrench into the traditional legal understandings of force and consent in rape cases.
Yeah, big time. It set some major precedents, especially when it comes to how much weight the victim's testimony gets and the role of verbal resistance.
And this all happened way back in the early 80s. Makes you wonder how much has changed or hasn't changed in the decades since.
Right. That's a great question. And in the next part, we're going to explore the lasting impact of Sherry. We'll look at how it affected, you know, both legally and culturally, how we think about consent.
Sounds fascinating.
Yeah.
Stay tuned, folks, because we're going even deeper into the world of Commonwealth v. Sherry and why it still matters today.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome back. So we've been really getting into Commonwealth v. Sherry.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, the more we dig in, the more complicated it gets.
It is.
It's not just about this one case. It's about how the law even tries to deal with something as complex as consent.
Right, because consent is so nuanced and so subjective. And this case is still debated today, decades later, because of that.
Yeah.
It brings up fundamental questions about how we even define consent, how do you prove it, and then what about power dynamics, you know, in sexual encounters, and, you know, that age-old legal question, how do we protect everybody, the victims, A&ED, the accused.
Right. Right. Okay, so before we went to part two, we were talking about how the appeals court said, okay, we're going to drop two of the rape charges for each defendant.
Yeah.
Because
right.
They saw the assaults as one continuous thing. And that just felt like kind of technical to me.
Yeah.
Did that decision actually change anything, like legally, for how these cases are handled?
Okay, so it definitely had an impact, but legal precedent. That's always tricky. It's never just, oh, this case means this and it applies to every case after. But Sherry, it definitely highlighted something important. Courts, they got to look carefully at the sequence of events, the nature of events, especially in sexual assault cases, because it matters when you're trying to figure out how many charges are appropriate.
So it's not as simple as like three assailants that equals three counts of rape.
Not necessarily. Not always. What Sherry did was it drew a line between a single continuous assault.
Right.
And then multiple distincture assaults. And that is subtle.
Yeah.
But it matters.
Yeah.
Because that can change the severity of the charges.
It makes you realize that even though the law is all about objectivity, there's always like a human element of judgment there, you know?
Oh, for sure. And that's where Sherry gets even more interesting. Because when you step outside of just the legal stuff, it had a huge cultural impact.
Like how we think about consent as a society.
Exactly. Think about it. This was decided in 1982.
Yeah.
That was a time when how we viewed sexual assault, it was changing a lot. The feminist movement was really challenging traditional ideas about rape,
right.
Saying, hey, a victim shouldn't have to physically resist to prove they didn't consent.
So Sherry kind of happened at like a perfect time when those ideas were gaining traction.
Exactly. And the court's decision, especially that focus on verbal resistance.
Yeah.
It aligned perfectly with those changing views. Sherry basically gave legal backing to the argument that consent isn't just the absence of a no.
Yeah.
It's got to be an enthusiastic yes.
That is a big difference.
Huge. Because it shifts the burden.
Yeah.
It's not the victim's job to prove they didn't consent. It's on the accused to make sure they actually got consent. Clear consent.
That makes a lot of sense, I think.
It does.
Yeah. And that idea, that's had a ripple effect, hasn't it? It's not just in the courtroom.
Mm-hmm.
It's in how we talk about sexual assault now, consent, relationships. It's everywhere.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
And, you know, Sherry, it helped to legitimize the idea that a victim's voice matters.
Mm.
Their words matter, even if they don't fight back physically.
It makes me think about, like, how much those old ideas of rape, you know, the woman attacked in a dark alley kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
How much those stereotypes have stuck with us? Sherry says, nope, it's more complicated than that. Assault can happen anywhere. And it's often about, you know, subtle forms of pressure or manipulation.
It's not always obvious. And that's why Sherry still matters so much. It made society and D, the legal system, look at consent in a way they never had before.
Right. I'm guessing, though, not everyone was happy with the outcome.
Of course not.
Or with how it changed things long term, right?
Any legal decision that shakes things up that much,
yep,
it's going to cause controversy.
Yeah.
And there was, and there's still, I guess, a big debate about the implications of Sherry. Some legal experts, defense attorneys, they say that it swings things too far in favor of victims.
Oh, okay.
That it makes it harder to defend against these accusations.
So their worry is that if you emphasize the victim's story and you don't require that physical resistance, the system becomes more vulnerable to false accusations.
That's one of their arguments, yes. They say, look, this creates a situation where it's too easy to convict someone based on just he said, she said, and that could lead to innocent people going to jail.
I can see that concern, for sure. I mean, you have to protect victims, but you can't do that by ignoring the rights of the accused.
Yeah.
It's a tough balance.
It is. It is. It's really difficult. And, you know, on the other side of that debate,
yeah,
are the people who see Sherry as a huge win, the victory for victims.
Right.
They say that requiring physical resistance, that just ignores reality.
Right.
The reality of trauma, of power dynamics.
It's like what we were saying before,
yeah,
about freezing up.
Mm-hmm.
Some victims shut down.
Absolutely.
That's not consent. It's just a natural reaction to fear, to a threat.
Right. And it also ignores the fact that fighting back could make things so much worse.
Yeah.
A lot of victims, they make the choice not to fight, even if they are terrified, because they don't want things to escalate.
So it's like a catch-22. Mm-hmm. You want to encourage victims to come forward and be believed, but you don't want to create a system where any accusation automatically means someone's guilty.
That is the dilemma, yeah. And it's a conversation that hasn't gone away. Sherry didn't solve the problem, but it definitely made us face it.
Yeah.
And start to think about solutions that protect everybody.
It seems like there's no perfect answer. You know, every case is different and the legal system has to deal with these gray areas.
Yes, they do. And that's another reason why Sherry is still so important. It shows us that the law is always changing, evolving, trying to keep up with how society changes and how we understand complex issues.
Sherry wasn't just a legal decision. It was like a cultural moment.
Yeah.
And that moment is still shaping how we think about consent.
Absolutely. And as we go into the last part of our deep dive,
okay,
we're going to explore what Sherry can teach us about how W navigate consent in our own lives. What lessons can we take away from this case and actually use in our relationships, our everyday interactions? What does it really mean to give and receive consent?
That's a question we should all be asking, for yeah, sure. Stay tuned, because we're about to get personal with the impact of Commonwealth v. Sherry. Welcome back, everyone. It's the final part of our deep dive into Commonwealth v. Sherry. And man, it's really made me think. This case, it goes way beyond the courtroom.
It does, yeah. It raises questions about how we approach consent in our own lives, you know, every day.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Like, one of the biggest takeaways for me, consent isn't just about the absence of a no.
Right. It's about more than that.
It's got to be a clear, you know, enthusiastic yes.
An enthusiastic yes, yeah. And that takes communication, you know, real, open, honest communication.
Yeah.
Which is something that Sherry really highlights.
Yeah.
You know, the danger of just misinterpreting things and making assumptions, especially when you've got these power dynamics going on.
Yeah. And going back to the case, that doctor-nurse dynamic,
right,
that's a prime example. Even if, you know, she hadn't protested verbally, the fact that you've got these doctors, this nurse,
yeah,
that imbalance of power, that alone should have been a red flag.
Exactly. And it makes you think, you know, how often do those kinds of power dynamics, even the subtle ones, how often are those affecting how we see each other, how we interact every single day?
It's like a blind spot almost.
Yeah. You don't even realize it.
We might not realize how much our position, you know, whether we have power or we don't, how much that's influencing how we read someone. Their words, their actions.
So self-awareness is key.
Yeah.
Really ask yourself, am I the one with the power here? Is there any chance that what I'm doing, what I'm saying, could be taken the wrong way? Could it be putting pressure on the other person?
And on the other side of that, if we're the ones feeling pressured or unsure, mm-hmm, we got to feel like we can speak up.
Yeah.
And say, no, this isn't okay with me, even if it feels awkward.
Exactly. And that is where, Sherry, that emphasis on actually saying it.
Yeah.
That becomes so important. You can't just hope the other person picks up on your vibe.
Right.
You got to be clear about your boundaries, what you expect.
It's like consent isn't like this magical thing you could just sense in the air.
Right. No.
You got to talk about it.
You got to be direct.
Plain and simple.
And, you know, it's not just a one-time thing. It's ongoing. Consent can be taken in back at any time, and that has to be respected.
So how do we take all of this, the legal stuff from Sherry and how it's changed society, how do we actually live that out in our own lives? Where do we even start?
Well, I think awareness is the first step.
Okay.
Pay attention to the little things, the cues. When you're interacting with someone, are you really listening to what they're saying? Not just their words, but their body language too. Are you checking in with them, making sure they're comfortable, that they're actually into it?
And are we being honest with ourselves about our own intentions? You know?
Yeah.
Are we sending mixed signals? Or making assumptions about what the other person wants.
Yeah, and it's also about respecting boundaries, even the little ones. If someone says no, even to something that seems small, you got to respect that. Don't pressure them to change their mind.
It all goes back to that basic idea. No means no, no matter what, no matter who you are, what the situation is.
Yeah, and at the end of the day, I think it's about creating a culture where everyone can speak openly and honestly, where we can all talk about our desires, our boundaries, without fear of being judged.
So, Commonwealth v. Sherry, this case, it wasn't just about redefining consent legally. It was about changing how we as a society understand what consent really means.
Yeah, and that change, that's still happening today.
It is.
We're talking more openly about consent than ever before.
Right.
We're challenging the old ways of doing things. We're making space for everyone's voice to be heard.
It's a journey, that's for sure. A long and complicated one. But Sherry, it shows us how far we've come, but also how much further we have to go.
You're absolutely right.
Well, that wraps up our deep dive into Commonwealth v. Sherry. I know it's made me think differently about my own interactions. Hopefully our listeners feel the same way.
Me too. I think the big takeaways here, clear communication, respecting boundaries, and be willing to question your own assumptions about consent. That's how we build healthy, respectful relationships.
Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time for another deep dive into the legal world and how it affects all of us.